wanted to talk about today is diffuse knapweed, and the question that I've been interested in for a number of years is, well, how many agents are really necessary for successful biological control? As many of you know, that diffuse knapweed is a serious rangeland pest. It occurs in dry areas from British Columbia in the north to Colorado, and there are several million acres of this species, which is of a Eurasian origin. Now, the work in British Columbia started with Peter Harris, who in 1970 did the first introductions of insects on knapweeds, and he was very enthusiastic in his battle against knapweed, and it's too bad that he retired before success seems to have occurred, but so I sort of tribute this to him. There are 12 different species, by my count, of insects and fungus that have been introduced over 20 years on knapweed, and some of these red arrows point to the different areas that are attacked on the seed heads, on some seed leaf beaters, some things like the beetles that feed on seedlings, and various things on the roots. This work was done with the collections and testing of insects being done by CABI, the introduction and research being done by Agriculture and Agri-Foods Canada, and then introductions being made by the British Columbia Ministry of Forests. Now, the background here is that there are several views of how you think biological control is going to work. On one hand, what is the prevalent view is that there is increasing stress of the plants by different agents. Peter Harris used to refer to this as the, if you have United Way with their big thermometer out there and it keeps building up and building up, and then eventually you get whammo and successful biological control. Another view of this is that maybe there are a limited number of agents out there that really do have impacts on the population density of the target weeds. And so a single species, if you get the right one, can be successful. The first of the agents to be introduced widely were the gall flies Europhora, Europhora finis, and Europhora quadriphasiata. And this is a story similar to what we just heard. Europhora quadriphasiata snuck in without being recognized and was released. So we have these two cogeners widely distributed now. The second species that was widely distributed is the root-boring beetle Sphenoptera. And in my study area, it was introduced in 1976 to the White Lake study area that we have been following over time. So what were the impacts of these two insects, one feeding on the seed heads and the other feeding on roots, but not killing the plants, reducing their growth rate, their time until they would bolt, and thus seed production as well? Well, the combination of the flies and Sphenoptera resulted in a 95% reduction in seeds by knapweed. Well, what does this do to plant density? We followed the density of knapweed in several sites around British Columbia. And as many of you probably know, it's very difficult to get research money for following or any weed control program. And the longer it goes, the less likely you are to get any funding. Nobody wants to know. So we did this work sort of sometimes holiday trips through the interior of British Columbia. I would stop, make the kids wait in the car, which they hated, and I would go out and throw down some quadrats and get some measurements of what was happening to diffuse knapweed. So this is a picture of what was happening at the White Lake site over time. This is the density of flowering plants. And you can see that in a few dry years, the density went down, but then immediately when the rains came back and the density came back as well. This is through to 1995. I was getting pretty bored with this project. Other agents were introduced in the late 80s and 90s, Siphocleones, that feeds in the roots and is very damaging. Its problem is that it doesn't fly, so getting it distributed is a problem. And then the root-boring Agapetta zonigena was introduced in the 1990s. It feeds in the roots of the knapweed plants. Little has been followed on this species in British Columbia. It occurs at low density at some sites, but it's not really widely spread. Then there was the weevil Laurinus minutus that was introduced and widely distributed during the 1990s in British Columbia and elsewhere. This beetle can do considerable damage in different ways. First of all, the red arrows here indicate where the beetles are. The blue arrows indicate the sort of feeding that it does in the spring as adults. In addition to that, the females will lay their eggs in the buds, and the larvae feed in the seed heads. They eliminate all the seeds in that seed head. I think actually it was Lincoln was the first one that mentioned to me some years ago about watch out for Lorinus because it really does do a lot of damage. It can in fact kill plants, and we had predicted in the past that what we needed for successful biocontrol of knapweed was not something that just messes around and reduces seed production, but something that could kill plants. Well, this is what happened then at White Lake. I don't know, for some reason in 1999 I was going through the Okanagan, stopped at White Lake, and measured the density and was shocked to see how it had gone down. I went back in 2001 and have since then gone, because now it's easy peasy to go out there and measure density, because you throw 30 quadrats and you get no knapweed plants in many sites. So that speeds this process up. So you can see then, since the about 2002, the density at this site has been very low, and that's associated with the establishment of Lorinus. Another site, Grand Forks, here we have both the rosette plants and the stem plants. Lorinus was introduced. Essentially, the knapweed is zero at this site, starting in about 2003. Another site, Cache Creek, here, again, there was a reduction in the plant density before I actually noticed Lorinus in this area, so I'm not quite sure what was happening there, but the density has remained low. And this did start to be successful during a dry period. The rain has come back in British Columbia, and it continues to be low, bounces around a bit, but it still stays at low density. There are two sites, however, that we have found where the density of diffuse knapweed has remained high. Both of these are higher elevation sites with higher rainfall. The one site, the blue site here, Buse Hill, we began first noticing that there were Lorinus in this site in 2005, and the densities have gone down slightly since then, but we'll have to see what happens. At Anarchist as well, the beetles have come in more recently, and the density does seem to be going down slightly, but there's still a lot of knapweed there. So these places that had not had the Lorinus more recently did seem to stay at high density and may be going down now. So, are both species necessary, with the Sphenoptera in the root and the Lorinus that is feeding on the plants and the seed heads? What actually makes this population decline? We needed to do experiments, and that was difficult because the beetles were everywhere and the knapweed was going down. But then God intervened and sent a fire through a site, and this knocked out everything, plants and insects. And then the knapweed reestablished more rapidly than the insects, so we had a small window of opportunity to try to do some experiments. What we did was we set up some cages in this site as the knapweed came back. And you can see there the white dots. There's quite a bit of knapweed a couple of years after the fire. And we used some experiments to try to identify the impact of these different insects. So we had these treatments. First, Lorinus on its own. Second, the root-boring beetle Sphenoptera. Then combination of Lorinus and Sphenoptera, a cage control, and an uncaged control. We did this at three sites that had been burnt, three replicates within each site, and the five treatments. And we did these experiments in 2005 through 2006. So these are the results. Now, the red circles indicate the Lorinus treatments, of which there are two, Lorinus by itself and Lorinus with Sphenoptera. This is with Sphenoptera on its own. And the blue is Sphenoptera by itself. This green is cage controls, and these are uncaged controls. First we have, in this graph, we look at whether our treatments were successful, and we see that Lorinus certainly was higher in these two treatments, but also beginning to come up in to the uncaged controls. We looked at the seed production, and we found that seed production was significantly reduced in those treatments with Lorinus, And we looked at leaf damage, and we found that the leaf damage was highest in those treatments that had Laurinus. In 2006, in the spring, we went out and measured plants, and we found that, again, the density, the number of rosettes and bolting plants was lowest in the Laurinus treatment. But also was reduced as compared to some sites. It was not significantly different from the Sphenopta treatment. But surprisingly, when we had both species together, there was no reduction in plants, and we really don't quite understand this. Looking here at the number of seedlings, we find again that the reduction is greatest in the Laurinus alone treatment. Autumn 2006, we found that if you looked at the density of Laurinus, now the controls had as much Laurinus as did the treatment. So the Laurinus had really moved into this site. However, here we have the number of seedlings, and we find that the uncaged controls and the Laurinus treatment had the lowest number of seedlings. And if we look at the number of rosettes, we find again that those are similar, with the combined treatment of Laurinus and Sphenoptera also being significantly lower than the caged control treatments. Again, evidence that Laurinus is having an impact. So our conclusions from these field experiments were that the greatest impact on plants occurred when the Laurinus weevils were present. And that for some reason, and we're beginning to try to explore this now, there was less of an impact when Laurinus and Sphenoptera were both present. So we conclude that it could be that Laurinus is a silver bullet, and I know that people don't like this idea that maybe there are silver bullets in biocontrol, but I think it's worth keeping that option open. It's very difficult to separate when you've had a situation where 12 species have been introduced. It's very difficult to separate out the impacts of different types of attack. Now, a student of mine several years ago looked at this question about, well, how many insects do you need for successful biological control? This was based on the data that is in the Julian and Griffith catalog, and we looked at those programs which multiple agents had been introduced, and then we looked at whether or not a single agent or multiple agents were attributed for success. And we find here that these data are not quantitative at all. It's a lot of, oh, I think this is what's happening, so it's very difficult to interpret. But we see knapweed out here. At that time, I think probably Peter Harris was saying that it was six agents that were successful. We feel that perhaps that knapweed should be moved over here to one agent. What do recent successes tell us? Well, a review of the literature, recent literature, I found that there were nine successful biocontrol programs reported in the literature in the last several years. Of all those, all of them said that it was one agent that was successful. So if we look at an update of those data, we get something like this. We move the knapweed over to being a single agent, we find that 25 of the successes that are recorded on weeds in the literature seem to be attributed to a single biocontrol agent. So our conclusions then are, following the introduction of Laurinus, diffuse knapweed has declined, and I think I'm not the only one to observe that. It seems to be having an impact widespread. In a majority of cases of biological control, one agent does seem to be sufficient. And does this matter? Does it matter if one agent is usually successful? Should that change how we look for agents? I think it's up to you folks that are involved in this process to decide. I think it's interesting. And I think it's important in this search for biological control agents to put more emphasis on efficacy. And I know Alec McClay, who's here in the audience, has written, I think, a useful paper on that. And we've got to make maybe some better choices when we're looking at different possible species for biocontrol. Acknowledgements. Many people have helped with this. Any project that started in 1976 and has continued to 2007 had a lot of people a lot of different agencies that we went and begged for money. And I'd like to also acknowledge my mentors, Peter Harris and Roy Cranston in particular, who did a lot of work in this system before success finally arrived. Thank you. Is there, the question is there anything in common or different between where Lorina seems to be effective and where it's not? And we haven't studied that in detail, but I've got a feeling that there might be phenology differences that we really need to look at when the beetles are coming out in those higher, cooler, moister areas. And also I think that even if they are feeding on the plants, that it probably is less stressful for the plants if it's a moister situation. So those are the types of hypotheses we're looking at now. Yes? After the fire was the regrowth of knapweed associated with the seed bank. I think it was, and I think that's very, I think that's the only explanation. And it does have a long seed bank, and it's one of these things that people have talked a lot about with, if you have, because there are these reductions in seed production, if it's gone down 95%, which is perhaps typical, you would think that there would be very little seed in the seed bank. But obviously from that experiment that there was plenty of seed left, and of course it produces so much seed that even 5% production per year, and if it lasts 5, 6, 7 years, it can build up.
Does Lorina feed on seedlings?
Does Lorina feed on seedlings? Yes, I think it does, yeah. Yeah, it chews, it does a lot of damage as adults just chomping away.